Hi, guys. We want to thank our great sponsor, Legion M. They are the first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They create really incredible experiences for people. If you're someone who wants to feel like you own a piece and are a piece of the industry, it's a great way to do it. They do meetups all over the country. They have a really cool community going online. I cannot recommend them enough. Go to legionm.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and we are sitting here just in the midst of greeting our latest guest, who you know because if you watch TV at all...
He lives in it.
That's right.
He lives inside the TV.
On that television set. His name is James Rodet.
That's right. And I'm not your latest guest because I wasn't punctual.
No.
I arrived 1 minute before we were meant to begin.
Most recent of our
great.
Guests.
I just want everyone to know that I showed up.
You are
on
our
time.
Present guest.
Yes, thank you.
Our current guest.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
in our cell.
Yeah.
Yes.
In our blockade and cell. Yes.
But no. We ought to create a different image, you know.
Like okay. How would you describe this place?
A swanky penthouse.
Ooh, nice. Yeah. Yeah. Nice.
It's a swanky penthouse. Anyway, James, it's a pleasure to have you here. And congratulations on your new series.
Thank you.
Which is called A Million Little Pieces.
Or A Million Little Things. We're doing the thing where we let people decide if they want to call
it
pieces,
it again,
pieces or things.
No, I don't think so. No.
Here's the problem. A Million Little Pieces captured the country's, you know, subconscious. Yeah. It was a big thing. And then we call the show A Million Little Things and wonder why people get it confused. It's on us.
Right.
Not you.
I guess it is.
Yeah.
I guess it is.
A Million Little Pieces came first, and we came second, and things and pieces are both sort of non-specific.
My goodness. Well,
common nouns.
How do the folks at the ABC television network feel about that?
I mean, they get it right on the posters and stuff. They've yet to make the mistake.
Well, okay. If you go into a Google search, or you're trying to find it somewhere, at least you have most of the name.
That's correct.
Yeah. So if you get that far... You should probably find what you're looking for.
Exactly.
Yeah. You're an actor of considerable experience, but you worked for so many years, 8, I believe, on Psych.
Yes.
With Dulé Hill, where it was really the two of you in the center stage, the spotlight. And you're now part of a larger ensemble. Are you flexing different muscles as an actor doing that?
Undeniably. Psych was one of the silliest shows ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And we got sillier as we went along. Mm-hmm. By the end, it was barely... There was such loosely constructed narratives on that show that you could barely even call it like a show that had structure.
Mm-hmm.
We were just making each other laugh any way we could. And this show is very different. It's very grounded. It's dealing with very, very real issues.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of us are dealing with in our lives, and with that comes a responsibility and an obligation to treat them as authentically as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that means flexing very different muscles.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's you know, people think comedy's easy, and mm-hmm. we all know it isn't. But this is a dramatic show.
Suicide is hilarious. So
suicide, yeah.
Never a bad time.
Do that tight five where all the jokes are about suicide. No, that's not what that is. Yeah. I think with anything, with any show, you never know how it's going to be received. You don't even know if it's going to go past the pilot. You show up, you try to get along with your co-stars as best you can, and you try to do something that doesn't suck.
Mm-hmm.
Then it takes on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much like getting on a train, because you as an actor are never really going to be able to dictate where the show goes or how people interpret it. But if they do care to interpret it and they do jump on board, that's your show. And you better jump on. And you better start figuring out how to do it well on a week-to-week basis if you want to last. And this show was embraced... I think initially by people who you know were being affected by those issues.
Mm-hmm.
They're either dealing with the loss of a loved one,
mm-hmm.
They're battling cancer, they're battling depression. Like, they started to feel seen, and as soon as you wake up to that reality, all of a sudden going to work becomes like, wow, like we're actually doing something, you guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so often it's like, when you do what we do, you you're getting paid more than you should generally, and you know, you're playing dress up and you spend an hour of your day having makeup put on your face, and you oftentimes question, like, what am I actually contributing? Mm-hmm. Anything? And I've been very lucky in that I've got to work on two shows that I actually think managed to find their way into people's homes. And with Psych, I think, you know, we were just giving people an escape and giving mm-hmm. families the opportunity to watch something together.
Yeah.
And with this show, you know, I think we're saying, hey, we know you're out there. We know you're dealing with this stuff. We want to get this right. We want to be a catharsis if we can be. And it's rare. It's rare to get to do that twice. So I count my blessings.
As you should. And it says something about you that you appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, what are we doing? You know,
yeah.
Go build houses, yeah. Help, you know, help put clothes on people that don't have,
exactly.
Go do something.
Exactly.
We talk about a lot, though. Escapism is very necessary.
Yeah.
And it's something that we all need at different times. So it's okay to have something be lighter.
Yeah.
It's okay for something to be funny. You and Dulé Hill are such a good team. You really are, though. But that show is exactly that, which is you put it on and you can relax and you can have fun and yeah. you enjoy yourself. And then this show is catharsis. And two very different kinds of, you know,
yeah.
one allows you to relax and laugh and one allows you to relax and cry.
Yeah.
You know, and both of those things are required for us to function in a healthy way.
And now that I feel like I've done both, I'm going to retire.
Right?
Yeah. It's called quitting while once.
And exactly.
Raise, and raise
exactly.
sheepdogs in a distant.
I'm going to John Elway this. In fact, I'm leaving right now. Thank you, guys.
I think that everybody should be Paul Newman.
Mm.
Like, get that. Like, what are you drinking right now? We could make that your thing.
This is called Uptime.
Okay.
It is a mental and physical energy drink. And what it's selling is that it doesn't have a bunch of stuff that's terrible for you in it.
Okay, mm-hmm. okay.
So it's all natural. And I drink it, and I convince myself that it's giving me energy. Uptime.
All right.
Uptime, all right.
Rodé
time.
Well,
in about 45 yeah. minutes, we'll report back to you.
That's
Thank
right,
you.
Yeah.
On but, our observation
maybe,
of your energy
Maybe that's
level.
Your thing.
Maybe that's my hot thing.
Rodé time.
My hot, fresh thing.
And,
yeah.
you know, and you make yourself a drink, and then, you know, and then you do the thing. My favorite is the salad dressings where they have him in different. There's Paul Newman as a gondolier.
That's right. Yeah.
This is exactly. When you think Paul Newman.
He really did find his thing, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't
he sure
there
did.
Like a philanthropic element to it?
Yes,
oh,
yes.
Oh, totally.
The proceeds went to
100%. Of the profits.
That's great.
Go to good causes.
That's fantastic.
And he leaves behind quite a legacy.
And it's delicious.
Quite apart from his
More importantly,
performance.
Though, the lemonade yeah. is delicious, and
it
that's
sure
what
is.
Matters.
It sure is. So, James, you come from Texas.
I do.
But What's that like?
No. But you don't sound like you come from Texas.
I don't. You know, I grew up mostly on a military base down there mm-hmm. in San Antonio, which is a very sort of, it's a cultural melting pot. It's mm-hmm. not like you're just there with a bunch of Texans. my mother was from California. My father was a second generation Mexican-American, mm-hmm. But from Texas. So I was exposed to people from all over the world, really, mm-hmm. For most of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't move off the base into the private sector until high school, almost, basically. So mm-hmm. at that point, that was sort of the rude awakening, because that's when I was just with a whole bunch of Texans, and there were people that came to school with their cowboy hats on and their
right.
boots, and
right.
there were a bunch of 10-ton pickups in the parking lot. And
San Antonio, that's real Texas.
It's very much real Texas, yeah. So that was high school was probably the most Texas experience that I had while living in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did you choose? How and why did you choose to go to New York?
I played sports most of my life growing up, and then, you know, once I moved off the base and saw that all the other guys that were playing sports were about twice my size, and I was going to get killed, I decided that maybe I should consider pivoting to something else that interested me, which had also, you know, the other thing that I loved growing up was movies and acting, and I'll come back to that because you actually played a role.
Whoa.
You did. You, sir.
Hmm.
And our theater department at my high school was treated essentially like a conservatory program. Like, our director took it very seriously.
How lucky for you.
Very, very much so. You couldn't do other things. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were doing theater, you were just doing theater. So I got very serious about theater at 14. And for 4 years, that was, you know, my jam in high school. And when it came time to figure out what our next move was, you know, I sat down with him and I was like, look, I need you to tell me a couple things. A, do you think I'm good enough to pursue this as a career? And you won't hurt my feelings. Like, I'm trusting you to give me some real advice here. And B, if you do think that, should I go east or west? And he gave me this seal of approval and he said, New York, no question. So those decisions were made for me by a man for whom I had great respect. Mm-hmm. He recently passed as well, Dr. James Buchanan. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
But you don't have his teeth around your neck.
I do not have any of his teeth.
Okay.
You can't make that reference without explaining.
I think I can. I think it's funnier if no one knows why I'm saying that.
Oh, okay.
He's got two of his dogs. His dog passed away, and he's got two teeth, and they're on a necklace. But not your teacher's teeth.
But
that is all.
I should say I wore these teeth for years while my dog was very much still alive. It's not just a memorial.
Is that like to live in fear?
It was just
like don't you mess, man.
I just love feeling like he's always sort of with me.
Yeah, of course.
You know?
Well, that's nice.
But anyway, before I forget.
Yeah.
I was an only child and, you know, sort of a latchkey kid. Mm-hmm. My world was basically made up of going to sports practices and watching movies. Mm-hmm. And my mother, and what I thought was an inspired piece of parenting, gave me a video card to the video store that I could ride my bike to. And we made a pact because I showed an interest in horror, especially at a very early age. And the pact was, as long as you aren't renting movies with a bunch of naked women in it, you can rent movies that otherwise children shouldn't, including yourself, have no business watching. And I took it very seriously. And so I only would rent horror movies that were rated R. And even when nobody was with me, I would look away if a woman got in the shower, because I felt like this was a pact. You know, I'm only as good as my word. Mm-hmm. And my guide for all of this was this book that I got in my stocking one year, which was it was basically just every movie you had reviewed up to that point in your life, little capsules. Mm-hmm. And it was essentially IMDb before there was IMDb, because you had these indexes by actor and by director too. Mm-hmm. So I would watch a movie, like I would watch April Fool's Day, which is one of my favorite comedy horror gems that nobody's ever seen. And I was like, dude, that guy's funny. Who is that guy? Turned out to be Thomas F. Wilson, which is how I found my way to like Let's Get Harry. Like, I would go to your book and be like, who is this dude? And then find out other stuff they had been in, and that's sort of how I rented movies. So to you, I say thank you.
And to you, I say you're welcome. Welcome. If it served you well, then I'm very pleased.
It was like an encyclopedia, and it's how I sort of built my filmic vocabulary. Now, granted, I wasn't out there watching great movies all the time. I was watching a lot of obscure 80s horror, but I could name so many actors and actresses that made livings doing low-budget horror in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Which is not incredibly useful now.
No.
But it's burned in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was fertile ground back then.
Yeah. And then you would re-up it. Like, each year a new volume would come out,
yep.
But, and you would add new stuff to. And
45 years.
Come on.
That book. And he was 18 when the first one was published.
That's awesome. And I had it.
Again, bless you. Bless you, sir. So you headed to New York.
I did. I headed to New
York. With a specific goal?
I went to NYU. I studied acting in their undergrad department.
But I read the experimental theater program.
Correct. The way that program is set up is it's kind of like a supermarket. They have somebody teaching all the different acting disciplines, and you have to stay, I think it's 2 years, you have to do one of them, and that sort of becomes like your core training. And then after that, you can shop around and bounce around and do whatever you want. And I did my core training in the experimental theater wing, primarily because it was definitely the loosest of all the curriculums that they offered. They weren't jamming like one technique down your throat. It was basically a bunch of hippies who did a lot of experimental theater in the 60s, believed in getting comfortable with your body first and foremost. So everybody had to do a show where they were naked. And it sounds ridiculous, but I watched so many inhibitions get shed in that program, because once you go up in front of your peers, who the hell knows, without a stitch of clothing on, there's not a whole lot that you're afraid of doing after.
No,
that.
I'm sure it's a really not just useful, but I mean, but a fundamental part of acting, on, especially on stage.
This is the instrument. This is what you got, and this is all you got. So you might as well get comfortable with it. And that was great. That was the best part of the training for me. You know, plus you're, you know, 18, 19, 20, you're constantly surrounded by naked, other people that are naked. I mean, it's not a terrible...
No, not a terrible jam.
Not at all. What inspired you to kind of want to start your own theater company?
I got very, very lucky. I got my first job in television in my last year of college. And my life sort of turned on a dime because I, like everybody else I went to school with, was focused on theater. It was about finding the best bartending job you could find and living an honest New York theater actor's life. The next thing I knew, I was in Los Angeles doing a television show for Fox, not even knowing what it meant to hit a mark, knowing nothing about lighting or cameras or any of that stuff. And I had a feeling that it wasn't going to be something that, you know, was fleeting, and that, again, it's like you get on the train and you ride the train because you're not going to dictate. I love it when people think that they can somehow dictate what their career in this business is going to look like. It's like the top one half of one half of one half of one half of percent can actually do that. The rest of us are just getting work. And so I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to be out in L.A. way sooner than I ever imagined. I don't want to lose the reason that I became an actor to begin with. I don't want to get too far from my roots. And if I start a theater company with another buddy of mine who also went to NYU, I at least know that, you know, when our schedules allow, once a year, once every 2 years, we'll come together, we'll make theater. And if people see it, great. And if they don't, that's not the point. So that's why we started.
And maintain it?
And maintain it, yeah. We still produce. We did a show in 2018.
Great.
And tell people what it's called.
It was called Cal in Camo, and it was the West Coast premiere. We did it down on Pico at the Versus Theater. It was a great production that I'm very proud of. I was mostly in Vancouver working on the TV show. But Bree Turner and my partner Brad Rader and another lovely actor named Tim Cummings rocked it out, and it was... it was a good one.
And the name of the troupe is?
Red Dog Squadron.
Okay. Red Dog Squadron.
And we stole that from the text of the first play we ever produced, which was David Mamet's Sexual Perversity in Chicago.
Well, if you're going to steal from the best.
if you know that play or that movie, it's sort of the opening speech that Bernie gives where it's completely full of shit, but he's talking about this sexual encounter that he had with a woman where a fire started. And it's, you know, his whole character is that he just tells stories.
Can you do Mamet easily? Can you do the...
Can you...
Is there a way... Could you possibly... Is there a way that you could do the...
I think
And Mamet is really interesting.
I think you just have to... You just have to buy in. That's it. People who think they're going to put their own spin on it, I think, are the people that struggle. It's just, it was written in a very specific way. You know, he has his own studio at NYU, by the way. His Practical Aesthetics Workshop, where he basically teaches you... to just use the words. That's all you need. You don't need anything else. Just use the words. It's all about the language.
Well, you've learned other things from being in television because you've been writing and directing TV as well as acting on it.
Again, very lucky. I got on Psych. They knew going in. I had just had I'd co-written a horror movie with my best friend, two of my best friends that had been made poorly, but made. And I was coming off that experience when I got Psych, so they knew that I had, you know, a screenwriting credit and never made me ask for anything on that show. Like, they came to me and said, do you want to write? They came to me and said, do you want to direct? Like, I never had to beg. I never had to ask. I never had to put it in a contract. Just had a great show creator who recognized that, like, hey, if we're going to be doing this for a while, like, let's make the most of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he let me start writing in the first season, which is crazy and unheard of. And he let me start directing in the third season.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of how I built my vocabulary as a filmmaker, knowing that I also ultimately wanted to make movies as well. But it's a great training ground, because you're surrounded by people who want you to succeed and who bring their A games for you and lift you up and help you learn and never make you feel stupid for not knowing something. And your job is to just soak all that in and be a sponge and never try to pretend like you know something that you don't know, because mm-hmm. what's the point of that? Mm-hmm. And it was wonderful.
Episode one that you directed,
mm-hmm.
what did you learn?
First thing I did was pick what I know. Mm-hmm. The first episode I directed was our homage to slasher films of the 80s. It was called Tuesday the 17th, and it was basically a mashup of an amalgamation of all the Friday the 13ths and April Fool's Day, which mm-hmm. I already referenced.
Great.
And I said, you know what? Those movies are burned into my brain. The way they're shot was burned into my brain. I know I'll be able to articulate exactly what I'm looking for here. And I'm not going to stretch more than I should my first time out. We were also shooting on Super 16 back then.
Mm.
So it was one of the few times I've got to shoot on film.
Oh, nice.
And
film.
I know. Can you believe it? Can you believe it? What I learned, I think, in that experience was that directing was everything I hoped it would be and more. Mm. And even back then, I could very easily sort of look into a crystal ball and say, I could imagine, you know, transitioning pretty fully from in front of the camera to behind the camera at some mm-hmm. point.
It gave you that satisfaction.
It gave me really deep satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And again, at that point, it was sort of a new toy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was shiny. But that feeling has not subsided at all over the years. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you can influence a piece of material so much more as a director than you can as, you know, an actor for hire. Mm-hmm. And I think actors so often have the experience of, you know, doing the best work they can in a project that ceiling is relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can walk away going, hey, I think I did pretty good work. And you always have to sort of drop these disclaimers like, now, the movie's not great, you know, or the show's okay, but I feel like I'm, you know, and as a director, like, you actually do have the capability to put your fingerprints all over something and, you know, potentially raise the level of the material, make the story better, make it look better, you know, put the right actors in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, along with that comes the responsibility that if it does suck, it's tough to point the finger at a whole lot of other people.
Right.
But I embrace that. I mm-hmm. if it's going to be shitty, I want it to be because I made it shitty,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Damn it. I made it.
No.
But it is interesting, though, because you, your first time directing, you were directing yourself as well. And we're always sort of fascinated by that, because I can't, obviously you have a great crew and you have people that you trust.
Yes.
And that's really what it's about. Is there enough people there that you go, no, someone will say, no one will go, yeah, that's fine, you're okay.
Right.
Somebody will say to you, no, I didn't like how that
went. You don't have it, you got to go again.
But that's a whole other art form.
I don't care for it. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. I just think it must be really tough.
I get annoyed every time that I have to, you know, leave the video village and go act. I like being able to see what every camera's doing. I like being able to, if something happens on accident that you didn't plan for and you see it and it's even better, I like being there for that moment, mm-hmm. because then you go, you know, you can open up a whole new avenue of, oh, wow, what if we did this? And it's hard. You don't get to see any of those things when you're having to act. So on Psych, it was a function of, I had no choice. Outside of Psych, I don't know why I would ever do that again. I know it works for some people. I feel like, especially with, you know, big movie stars and stuff, I understand that sometimes if you want a studio to give you $80 million and you're a huge movie star, you're probably going to have to be in it too.
Mm-hmm.
So I get that part of it. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, I just don't know why you would ever want to wear both of those hats, because I don't actually believe that nothing is compromised. I don't believe that one side doesn't suffer a little bit or goes back and forth, you know? I just don't.
It would seem, but and yet the honor roll of people who've done it really well is long.
It's absolutely true.
But yeah, we both, as I say, we both are always thinking about that, because I just can't, I can't imagine having both of those things to deal with at the same time.
But, you know, to each their own, too, though. I mean, who am I? Who am I to say that, like, there are people that probably really love it and, can't imagine not doing both.
But we're talking about you.
For me, for you. I find it annoying.
So, when you're working in episodic television, so much is already set in place. The regulars, the co-stars are set. The shooting technique is pretty much set. You know, your production designer's done his or her work.
You know what you're dealing with.
It's definitely a well-oiled machine. I would say Psych was one of the rare instances where, because there were almost no rules on that show, and we were going into different worlds every week and doing departure episodes and doing entire episodes that existed in people's minds or dreamscapes or whatever. As long as you could jam it in 7 days, you could make one episode look completely different than another episode. I mean, it's like, you know, I feel like they're doing that on some shows. Atlanta, I think, has fun like that. Aziz's show was doing stuff where, like, week to week, you were walking into something completely different. But we were doing that, you know, back in 07 and 08 and 09. And again, I think it sort of accelerated the learning curve, because every time I stepped behind the camera, I got to do something different. I got to use a new gadget. I got to play with a new toy. I was writing things specifically because I hadn't shot them yet. You know, I would write a big action sequence or a car chase or you know, an explosion, just because I was like, I need to know how those get prepped and shot. It was very self-serving.
That's great.
You guys.
No, but that's but that's so cool.
What an opportunity! My gosh, what an opportunity!
For sure.
Golden opportunity. So what's it been like working behind the camera on other shows? You've done a number of episodes of other series.
I've bounced around. I've usually done it to work with pals who are now running shows. It's great when, like, you know somebody in earlier in your careers where you're both hustling, and then you both get to a place where, like, you know, my best friend's running a show on Fox called The Resident, and it's like he runs a show. So he's like, come, you know, come direct a few episodes and we'll go down to Atlanta. And it's just like, can you believe this? Like, this is crazy. Like, we went to high school together. Like, this is insane. So I'll do stuff like that. I did one job down in South Africa that was a sci-fi show called Blood Drive that never quite popped or found the audience that I think they were hoping for. But it was sort of a tribute to Grindhouse.
Yeah, I watched it.
And that was a blast. I mean, it was just deep, dark, nasty, guerrilla ninja filmmaking in Cape Town, South Africa. We were essentially shooting X-rated material, and the studio was just telling us, like, shoot it as it's written. We'll figure out how to air it. So I was shooting things that I never thought that I would shoot, not just on a sci-fi show, but maybe ever. And then saying, all right, you told me to do this. And to their credit, they aired most of it, and they would do crazy stuff, like put big black boxes over stuff that you weren't allowed to see. They were throwing up all kinds of warnings, and they I think they were airing it at like 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night. But that was an experience that I will always appreciate and remember, because I don't, you don't get to do that very often when you're not working on, you know, premium cable. I mean, this wasn't Netflix or HBO. This was the old sci-fi channel, and it was awesome.
Well, you know, people used to direct movies. People used to direct TV. Now we're all creating content.
Oh, he does not like that word. He is not a fan of that word at all.
Now, as
what
an
do you
actor,
do? I'm a content creator.
Flipping no, to the no, actor side of the coin for a few minutes. What actors did you admire when you were growing up or getting started in the business? Not only for their work, but for the way they handled themselves, and for the way they steered their career as much as you can steer a career.
Yeah, exactly. You know, well, it was pre-internet, right, when I was a kid. So you kind of got to decide what kind of people they were. which is very helpful because nowadays it's just too easy to find out that someone that you really admire is a jerk.
Yeah.
But back then, you know, you were just admiring them for their work.
Right.
You know, and unless they killed somebody, you never heard that they were.
And even then.
Yeah.
And even then.
You never heard that they were jerks. I'm obviously setting up my answer. I'm prefacing because I grew up essentially, it was hero worship. Val Kilmer was my idol.
Oh, yeah.
He was someone who I felt had mastered both comedy and drama.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first time I ever saw him on screen was in Real Genius, which is one of my favorite comedies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So my introduction to Val was as a comedic actor, which I think is the thing he probably gets least credit
for.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And then he was sliding in and out of roles and showing the kind of range that I was just like, this is acting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this guy can do anything he wants. He was playing Batman and Doc Holliday at the same time with because those two movies had a little bit of overlap, which I thought was just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then he played Jim Morrison and this, you know, the work he did in Heat. You know, I was like, man, that's the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Round about the same time, I thought, you know, Sean Penn and Daniel Day-Lewis were obviously on that level as well. I would say those are sort of the three.
Well, you've chosen
one. Just a solid three, yeah. If you're going to do it.
I did get to work with Val.
Oh, yeah?
Briefly. I didn't share the screen with him, but in the Psych series finale, we had this character that we had been referencing the entire run of the show. It was a detective who always lived just off camera and was being yelled at by Lassiter, Detective Dobson. And in the series finale, we finally did a reverse. And it was Val Kilmer, as if he had been on our show for 8 years.
That's so cool.
Working in the Santa Barbara Police Department.
That's fun.
Came and he did that as a favor, and I was nervous, you know, because there's a lot of crazy shit out there about Val over the years, and I was like, please, please come and be awesome. Please come and be awesome. And he was a peach. He was so sweet to everybody.
Oh, that's nice.
We had fun with him, and. And then I went to see his one-man show.
Well, I haven't gotten to see him play Mark Twain. You have.
It's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
It's constantly evolving. It was one of the most unique theatrical experiences I've had because he comes out in full prosthetics.
Mm-hmm.
He does the show. The show's over. He comes back out with his makeup artist. He sits down in a chair, and you watch her turn Mark Twain back into Val Kilmer.
Wow.
While he says, tell me what worked for you guys. Tell me where you got bored.
Huh.
Tell me what you wish I would have done more of or less of. And he's constantly improving the show because he seems to be touring it forever.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this is it. This is what he's going to do for the rest of this.
Well, that's what Hal Holbrook did.
Yeah.
So he's following the tradition, you might say.
Mm-hmm. But it was so cool. It was interactive. And he's a very, very, very talented dude.
Mm-hmm.
I liked his Batman.
I liked his Batman too.
A lot of people liked his Batman, but I liked his Batman.
It was I think it represented a bit of a tonal shift in the series. And, you know, for me, I was just like, has there been a more suave Bruce Wayne?
I'm just saying.
No way.
It's up there.
He's like, come on. He was a good looking billionaire.
Yeah. Our favorite kind of billionaire.
That's right.
The good looking ones.
That's right.
Yeah. So he aced Bruce Wayne.
Yeah,
pretty much.
I'm so glad that he was what you had hoped for.
Me too.
Because that's so hard.
I was nervous.
So hard.
Yeah. I was nervous. And then I hung out with him a little bit backstage after his show, and he was awesome there too. So that's two for two, as far as I'm concerned. And then and those were just the guys. I also grew up. I love Meryl Streep.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mary Stuart Masterson for a while.
Oh, she's terrific.
Brilliant.
Was
brilliant.
Like my whole world.
Mm-hmm.
I had a picture of her from as Iggy from Fried Green Tomatoes in my wallet, as like a 15-year-old or something. And I told her, oh gosh, my first year at NYU, I saw her at a supermarket in the West Village, and I freaked out. And she just wanted to get some produce. Like she just wanted some zucchini or something. And this college kid comes up to her, and I'm like, I know this is gonna sound weird. Please forgive me. First year at NYU, you know, you were such an inspiration. I used to carry a picture of you around in my wallet. And she was such a dear. But I think, you know, there was still 20% of her that was like, that's That's a lot.
It's a little odd, yeah.
It's
yeah,
a lot
yeah,
what you yeah. did.
Well, she's a very talented woman.
Oh,
she's,
yeah.
And she's been directing a bunch, too. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense to me.
Yes.
She grew up around it. And
sure, her yeah. parents. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you have good taste, man.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you.
That counts a lot. So yeah. tell us about your first feature film that you directed.
It was definitely a labor of love. It was a script that I wrote with my best friend again in, I want to say, 2005. And we didn't actually end up making it until 2013. And it wasn't like it ever got shelved. Mm-hmm. It was, we attached a producer in 2005, and it was a constant battle. And it got set up and fell apart about four different times in four different tax credited locations. And because it was always competing with Psych, I only had this one little window to make it in, and it sure. was like trying to hit a moving target, and we just couldn't get there. But I also refused to give it up, one, because it was a bit of an obsession at one point, where you're just like, I'm going to finish what mm-hmm. I started. But the other, I just thought it was a very pure, unadulterated representation of his and I's voice as writers. Mm-hmm. And you only get to make your first movie once.
Yeah.
And, you know, let it be the thing that you want it to be. The movie's called Gravy, and it was very much exactly what I thought my first film needed to be. Mm-hmm. Tens of people enjoyed it. But the truth is, we held out long enough that we got the cast that we wanted. We shot it exactly how we wanted. It was inmates running the asylum, mad scientist in his laboratory, and it ended up being exactly what we had always imagined. And that's a very rare experience to have as a filmmaker. I'll cherish it for the rest of my life. I look back at it now, and I think, you know, you really didn't have a ton to say with that movie. But the experience, I think, was what was important. And establishing a voice and an aesthetic and a love for both comedy and horror, I think, is what is the purpose that movie served more mm-hmm. than anything. And just how much fun we had. And watching some of my best friends and actors with, you know, for whom I have great appreciation, like, trust me enough to go on that ridiculous ride. Sutton Foster, especially. You know, I love her, and she's so good, and she's Broadway's sweetheart, and the stuff I had her doing in that movie was just so foul. And watching her trust that, okay, I'm gonna let you cover me with blood, and I'm gonna say this stuff, and I'm gonna do this stuff. Like, it's so humbling, like, you know, to watch people like lift your material up.
Mm. Wow.
But the one thing I can say is that even while I was doing it, and certainly in the subsequent years, you know, I did have the thought of, like, okay, the next one needs to be a bit of an evolution.
but you have to cut your teeth somewhere, yes. though. That's the thing. You have yeah. to do it. And even, of course, while ideally, if we would have asked you when you started, do you want to wait 5, 6, 7, 8 years to do it, you would say, well, of course not. But then at the same time, you end up having all of this experience. You know, sometimes things do work out a certain way for a reason.
I think it happened the way it was supposed to, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that's, again, it's really exciting. It's exciting to do something like that and put yourself out there in a different way. Because there's, you know, the running joke, what I really want to do is direct.
Right.
It's very easy for that to be funny. And you'll see we're both compulsive credit readers. So, you know, when TV shows, I'll see, it's like, oh, look, so-and-so has now become the producer, executive producer, right. whatever. Oh, now so-and-so directed an episode. But there are a lot of really great people who do that. You know, there are a lot of great people who do it. And I think that it allows them to stretch different parts of themselves.
Before I took A Million Little Things, I was on like almost a 4-year run of directing exclusively. Mm. Like I told you guys, like, I was getting pretty serious, and I was mm-hmm. I was really starting to think, like, okay, you know, I'm gonna Peter Berg this. I'm gonna hang up the boots. Every once in a while I'll pop up and do something silly for like a buddy, but for the most part, you know, mm-hmm. I wanna take this directing thing seriously. I wanna mm-hmm. give it everything I have. And I want to make good work. And so I think that's what I'm going to do. And A Million Little Things was a real curveball. I didn't see it coming, and once it was put in front of me, and you sort of think about what it means to play a character like that, you kind of have to look yourself in the mirror and say, okay, if you pass on this opportunity as an actor, you are definitely saying that you don't want to act anymore.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah.
These kind of roles are really tough to come by,
right.
And you've got one sitting right in front of you. Mm-hmm. So this is the moment.
Yeah.
And
you're a young man. You have,
yeah, you got time, man. There's no rush.
I wasn't quite ready. I was like, you know what? I think you'll regret this.
Mm-hmm. But it's okay. You have time. It's not the sort of thing. But it's true.
No, it is.
It's true. You have time to do these things. Yeah. And of course, as you know, the more you do in any other field, the more you learn every time. And you keep saying, you know, sponge.
Yeah.
And that's exactly it. So, you know, your next movie will be even better.
Yeah.
And so on and so on and so on.
I want to talk to you about the life of a television actor.
Oh, yeah.
You have lived that for a while. And you were on two series that had brief but had runs, you know. And the first one was First Years, about recent law grads.
Or that's right. I remember
for going
years.
Back.
Yeah. And then you did Mismatch.
Yes, I did.
With Alicia Silverstone. So you had two series that obviously somebody believed in.
Right.
And a network in each case believed in him, mm-hmm. and thought they showed promise. They didn't yank him off after two right. weeks, which,
which
has been known
happened.
To happen, you know.
Yeah.
So that means that you as one of the co-stars have to invest in it to some degree. And then they pull the rug out.
You know, it's funny.
What's that like?
It was a good lesson because I did those two series for very different reasons,
mm-hmm.
thinking that there was some way to get ahead of like the business of this, and like mm-hmm. there was some formula, mm-hmm. and if I could figure it out, then I could get on a show that lasted. I did First Years because it was based on a British format called This Life, which was mm-hmm. a really good show, and I thought, oh, they're gonna come and do it like that, but for American television, mm-hmm. it's gonna be something that nobody'd ever seen before. It's sort of like the cinema verite kind of, mm-hmm. it's all very real, you know, handheld before handheld kind of thing. But then we showed up, and that's not how we did it. We very much did the American version mm-hmm. of that. And by doing it like that, it sort of kind of ended up not, you know, the one thing that it had as sort of a defining characteristic was real life in a way that you're not used to seeing on, especially, you know, network television.
Mm-hmm.
So when we didn't do that, you could kind of see the writing on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, that was a creative reason for doing something. Then Mismatch came along, and I was like, a vehicle for Alicia Silverstone? I'm going to have, you know, two scenes a week where I come in and say something snarky in a boardroom? This will run for 8 years.
Right.
Like, I'm in. So I chose that for very different reasons.
Sure.
And again, like, you just never know if something's going to work once it's up on its feet. And mm-hmm. that had all the pieces in place to be like a network television hit. I mean, divorce lawyer by day, matchmaker by night, Alicia's never done TV before. Like, what could possibly go wrong? And, mm-hmm. you know, for whatever reason, you know, it just didn't hit a sweet spot, yeah. and the ratings weren't there. And I was unemployed a year later.
It's fascinating, though. It's fascinating when you look at an actor's filmography, because there are so many of those shows.
Yeah.
And sometimes you'll look through and go, oh, yeah, I remember that one. Oh, I remember watching that. There are so, for the shows that make it, for the 10 shows that make it, there are 10,000 shows that didn't. And for you guys, for all of you actors who do this, saying a little death is too far, yeah. but it's like each time you sort of go, all right,
yeah.
here we go. And someone could say to you, no, this is going to be a success. This is going to be huge. And you go,
which is exactly what was my experience when I got Psych, because I hadn't had anything that lasted longer
right,
than a year.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
And so I had just grown to accept that, you know, it was a huge dice roll, not to expect anything. And then they pair me up with Dulé Hill, who's only known complete success. You know, he was 7 years of West Wing, mm-hmm. followed by 8 years of Psych, followed by however many seasons he did of Ballers, followed by however many seasons he's doing of Suits. Like, he only knows that when he gets on something, it's good. So when we
never
were
liked him
so
anyway.
When we were shooting that pilot, he was like, "Oh, this is gonna go," and I was like, "Okay, dude, yeah, all right, pal."
But that's a note to all actors: find Dulé Hill,
find Dulé
Figure
Hill,
out where he is,
get on
get
a show
on
with
show.
Him. Mm-hmm. That's it. Those are your marching orders.
Now, what was it like when you first saw a tiny you appear in front of the Simpsons?
Oh, crazy.
Because that's still my favorite thing. No. Because you're watching a TV show, and now the new ads are a tiny little version of the actors.
That whole
walking
that whole,
back and forth on the screen.
That whole experience was
you know,
wild.
Back to back. You guys had one of those back to back poses.
We did.
You know?
We did.
Like
we did.
New Kids on the Block.
That whole show. Like, it was just a sort of a strange, culty, cultural phenomenon
yeah.
that I don't think any of us saw coming.
Mm-hmm. Dulé Hill.
Dulé Hill is the magic ingredient. That is clear. But, you know, it was one of those things where you're just like, smell these roses
yep.
while you're in this garden mm-hmm. because this could be as good as it gets. And if that is the case, then make it, you know, make it everything. And to our credit, to our little psych family's credit, I think we always knew that. We always recognized that. We got lucky. Lightning in a bottle, a fledgling network that hadn't quite found its identity, mm-hmm. Gave us a hell of a lot more leash than we would have normally had. A cult audience, a cult fan base that's just, they're rabid. They call themselves psychos because they are. They're beautiful, beautiful psychos. And, you know, you can't be thankful enough when that happens.
Yeah.
Psychos. It's so funny because... We've known of actors who, the minute they land a series, they want to be out of it.
Don't get me started, man. I don't get it. I don't get the amount of complaining
yeah.
that goes on from actors who are gainfully employed.
Mm-hmm.
And look, we're all guilty of it at times.
Oh, but that's
sure.
human.
And you have to check yourself. But the bottom line is. I just think back at the people that I went to school with. There are so many insanely talented people out there that would trade places with you in a mm-hmm. second
mm-hmm.
while you're walking around bitching about this or moaning about that. I just wish you could walk around with like a big foam hand and slap people.
Yeah.
You know?
Snap it. Do the share. Just snap
yeah.
out of it. Whack
Come
em.
On.
Yeah.
And yeah. then you hear the stories about people on shows that don't speak to each other.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's
That's
just
a whole other.
It's just insane.
Yeah.
Makes me ashamed.
Well, no. You don't have to bear the front. You don't
Shame.
Have to bear the front for others.
Shame to be a part of this strange tribe.
Are there actors you've worked with, maybe guest shot actors, and maybe where you've done a guest shot on someone else's show, where you've just been on a set or in a scene and said, wow, been impressed by what they're doing right in front of your eyes?
Some of my favorite actors are also some of my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to work with them so much, and when they can continue to surprise you, or it's especially tough when you're watching someone you know that well, for them to pull it off on you is... It's really a testament to their ability. One of them is Jimmy Simpson. I've worked with him on two movies now, and he recurred on Psych, and I see him all the time, and he's one of my best friends, mm. and he still manages to do things, whether it's in a scene that we're in together or if I'm directing and watching him, that just I'll just lose myself, mm. and I'll forget that I'm watching one of my best friends. And then I'm just watching a real master of our craft.
We had him on the show, and we love him.
He's a real special cat.
Mm-hmm.
I feel the same way about Michael Weston, another mm-hmm. one of my besties. Who every time you think you've got a handle on what he's going to bring to the table, he'll show you something that you didn't see coming.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's why I'd lean on them in everything that I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Psych, we had a really hard time casting this role called Mr. Gang, who became like a serialized sort of bad guy over the course of the whole show. and ended up being Ally Sheedy. And it was, we thought it was going to be a little bit of a wild card. We didn't know what to expect. It was written as a man, and then it, we crossed over and it became a woman. And I had been a fan of Ally, you know, from the 80s.
Sure.
But I admittedly wasn't that familiar with what she had been up to, you know, recently. And she showed up and did some weird, cool, crazy stuff. So when your expectations are, we don't know what to expect, and then something comes in and is really, really dope, that's always fun. And she's also become one of my favorite human beings, too. She's just a beautiful kooky bird, that one.
That's a good way to describe her.
Yeah. Love Ally.
And have you, what kind of, I don't know if tips is quite the right word, what have you absorbed from the people who have directed you?
You know, it's weird because when you get on a TV show that runs for a while, like nobody wants to direct you anymore.
Yeah.
They think that like, oh, my job is to be a game manager, and these people have been doing this for so long. And that's, I think that's something that is, or at least for a lot of the actors that I know, mistakenly projected onto series television. Mm-hmm. I have no problems coming in and giving the lead of a show that's been on a show for 7 years a direction. It's like, look, I'm here to help you be as best as you can. You probably didn't think about this, or you don't know that you just did that. What if you tried it like this? Or what do you think? You just came from here. Do you think that maybe? In my experience, most actors are usually really grateful in that environment because they've been doing it for so long that they probably maybe don't think about those things the way that they would in season one, or the way they would if they were doing a movie. And to have a fresh set of eyes and a fresh set of ears that actually gives a shit come up and say, hey, I think this could be more interesting if we did, like, I always think that's great. So just being directed, period, when you're on a TV series, I think is cool and something that you don't always get, because I think directors are just skittish.
Mm-hmm.
And feel like, I'm only going to be here for 2 weeks and then I'm off to do, you know, who knows what. And
yeah,
these guys know what they're doing. But a good note is a good note, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, but also you're a smart person to look at it that way. But it's true. You know that. There are going to be some people who go, you think you need to tell me how to do this? I do this.
Right.
But I think especially the part I do understand for an actor complaining or being frustrated with a long series is because you may not get to do a lot of different things. Right. Now, what you're talking about with Psych, you got to play all kinds of stuff.
That's great.
And that's really cool, and that, I'm sure that helps.
Right.
But when a new, like you're saying, a fresh pair of eyes also means that it can reinvigorate you.
Yeah.
So on a day when you're sort of going, I got nothing, if somebody comes in and says, you know what, that was really great when you did XYZ, you think, oh, okay, that's cool. I like that. I'm happy I know that now.
It's great. And we've had some good directors on A Million Little Things. Because, you know, when you have an ensemble like that and everybody's roughly
this... Such a good cast.
It's a great cast. Everybody's roughly the same age and everybody's dealing with pretty serious stuff. Finding nuance kind of becomes everything,
mm-hmm.
right? Delineating these people, delineating their experiences, making everybody feel as individual as humanly possible so that you don't end up with just a collection of lamenting middle-aged folk. Kind of becomes like the number one challenge. And we've had some really good directors come in and sort of help us find those nuances. And it's all surgical stuff, but I think it makes a huge difference.
How many days do you shoot for an hour show?
Psych was basic cable. We didn't have any dough. So those were seven, those were 7 days, no overtime, and you just sort of figure out how to get it done. Network's a different ball game. You know, we'll do 8, 9, 10 sometimes if it's a tricky script.
Wow.
HBO shoots for a year if they need to. yeah, they just spend whatever. You know, I've heard stories about, you know, Game of Thrones. I have a buddy who directed a couple episodes of Game of Thrones, and it's just like this is perfect. This is the perfect example. I went to South Africa to do 2 episodes of Blood Drive. On the same day, he left to do his 2 episodes of Game of Thrones. I was back 6 weeks later. He was back 6 months later. We left on the same day. So there you have it.
So funny.
Scale. It's just a matter of scale. Yeah, that's all. That's all. You're doing the same thing. Just, you know, scale and perspective. Well, it must be nice to be settling in to a successful show again. and to be, as I say, flexing different muscles while you're doing it.
It feels good. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I am so lucky that this is the second time that I've settled into something where everybody gets along.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody respects the work. Everybody recognizes how difficult it is to land on something mm-hmm. that you believe in. They're great scene partners.
Mm-hmm.
The guys, you know, we have our cool guy thing. The ladies all have their thing in addition to all of us being part of the ensemble. My co-star, Allison Miller, is one of the best scene partners I've ever had. I mean, it's tough. We have to do so much stuff where, like, the stakes are life and death.
Mm-hmm.
Like, week in, week out, you know, cancer is a terrible, terrible, terrible disease.
Yeah.
And, you know, we both have it on that show. So, between the two of us, it's always just like, you know, the mortal coil is about to snap. And she is always somehow manages to find a new way to come at it. And I have happily stood on her coattails and let her drag me around for the better part of a season.
Well, because you're a smart guy.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
When you have an opportunity, seize it.
Right? Get on that coattail. Yeah. You find that tail.
That's right.
Now, I love Ron Livingston. I just love him.
He's exactly what you probably imagine he would be. There's just zero pretense.
Mm-hmm.
He comes in. He knows the drill. He's a pro. He's sweet. He's funny. He's open. He's approachable. But he also is on 12 shows.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's always sort of functioning on a sort of like boom, boom, got to go here, got to go here, got to go here.
He's kind of the definition of a working actor.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely
yeah.
is.
I met him one time and had the Porky Pig, abadee, 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 like nothing came out. Yeah. I just stood there and went, yeah.
I've been so impressed because that's a tough role.
Yeah.
And even like, even reading the pilot, and knowing that, you know, he was going to come back in flashbacks and stuff. It's like, how do you find ways to make this guy human when he's not alive anymore?
Yeah.
Like, how do you affect a group of people once you're already gone? And he's managed to do it. Like, it's a tough role, but I think he surprised me at just about every turn.
Do you have a script in your back pocket? If somebody said to you...
Do you have pockets?
Yeah.
And are there scripts in them?
Your next hiatus, we could fund another feature film for you to do.
That happened between the pilot and starting to shoot the series. And while I didn't have a script in my back pocket, I at least had an outline.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how we made Treehouse, which is the mm-hmm. movie that's going to be dropping on Hulu. Really soon, March 1st.
Hey.
No, I was in Vancouver shooting the pilot of A Million Little Things, and then Blumhouse called, and because they were fans of Gravy, as they should be.
Absolutely.
If anyone's going to be fans of Gravy,
can you see Gravy? Is Gravy a thing that one could find?
Gravy's out there. It's on Amazon. It's on it's on iTunes.
Okay.
Great.
We made a pretty solid deal with Showtime years ago where we gave them like exclusive cable rights, and it's on three times a week at 2 a.m.
Perfect.
So if you can't sleep, it's on Showtime all the time. But no, they said we're doing an anthology of films with Hulu. One horror movie a month. Each one is going to be loosely affiliated with a holiday. Do you got anything? And then there were like 3 months that were available. And the idea that I had been carrying around with me for a while kind of lines up perfectly with International Women's Day, which is in March, and that was one of the months that they didn't have anything for. So I hopped on the phone. I did my best snake oil salesman pitch. And in somewhat unprecedented fashion, 3 days later, they were like, okay. So it was a greenlit movie without a script where because of the schedule with the show getting picked up, prep and the writing process basically had to start on the same day. Mm-hmm. And so I, with my best friend again and the help of Juliana Gwill, who was in the movie and also produced the movie, and Jimmy, who also acted and produced, We just sort of we rolled up our sleeves and we did this crazy thing, and we had about a month to both write a script and prep a movie, and then 15 and a half days to shoot it, all because of my schedule.
Well, it is all about you.
Yeah, right.
It is. I'm the reason that it had to be that crazy and that difficult. But I have to say, like, I am so proud of the work that everybody did on this movie. I'm so proud to have been a part of it. It was an idea that Juliana and I started talking about years ago. Ironically, before Me Too or Time's Up. But the fact that those movements happened unquestionably made it an opportunistic, I think the right kind of opportunistic thing, because, you know, I can imagine a different time this movie taking forever to come together. Instead, like, it is the zeitgeist. You phone pitch it and you have a movie 72 hours later. But again, that comes with responsibility, because you don't want to be exploitative and you don't want it to seem like you're taking advantage or like you're being opportunistic about an issue that's so real and so serious. Mm-hmm. And so again, with all the crazy sort of variables surrounding it, we were like, but guess what? We need to make a good movie, you know? We have to, mm-hmm. otherwise, you know, F us. And that's what we set out to do. And so in that sense, it was very different than Gravy. I felt some responsibility that I did not necessarily feel the first time out. And it's also, as a man, because I have to be honest with both of you, I am a man.
Mm-hmm.
I am what I present as. You know, it is a movie that offers a very sort of specific, you know, perspective about the female experience. And the last thing you want to do is put out, you know, some bullshit mansplainy, this is a guy's version of what you guys are talking about thing. So, you know, we just hired a lot of really talented women in just about every position that you can have on a film set.
Terrific.
I ran everything by Juliana and the other women in my life who are important to me, and we just kind of all guided this thing to the finish line. So even though it'll say that, you know, I directed the movie, I really truly do feel like it took a village with this one, as it kind of needed to.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted this story to get told. I wanted to take advantage of the opportunity and the bird in hand. So that's why, you know, that's why I didn't hand it off to somebody else, because you don't want the story to not get told, especially when someone says you can go starting tomorrow.
Yeah.
But it was very important to me that it was sort of a cacophony of voices being represented. And you know, the movie has like five different endings. I kept coming to Juliana going, what do you think about this? Nope. Okay. What do you think about this? Okay. What do you think about this? I understand why you think that's cool, but trust me, that's not what you want to do. Until we finally, you know, landed at the one where it just seemed like, okay, this is it. This is how we want to participate in this conversation.
Wow.
Well, so be looking out for Treehouse, folks.
March 1st on Hulu.
Yes.
And I'm sure on days to follow on Hulu as well.
Yeah, I believe it is.
March 1st or
yeah, I believe it is available for at least the month of March, I hope.
But you missed your St. Patrick's Day opportunity.
Right?
I did. But you know what? You can just go watch Leprechaun Part 4.
17.
Or the one where he goes to space, and I think you get your fix.
Leprechauns in space.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you can find Gravy as well.
Gravy's out there to be had on streaming platforms. Maybe don't eat right before you watch it.
Okay.
But the name.
Gravy, yeah.
That's like.
Look, it's a cannibal horror comedy. That's what it is.
Oh, Daddy, it's right up your alley. Exactly.
With some really great gore and prosthetics, because I hate CG.
Practical effects.
It's all practical effects.
Good.
I'm a diehard horror hound.
You got a fan. My daughter. Yeah.
He will not watch a gory what have you, but I will watch.
The guys at KMB did me real solid on that movie, and the effects are top notch. Otherwise, you know, because we certainly couldn't afford that. But yeah, they really came through.
And then once a week.
Once a week.
On the calendar, you can watch A Million Little Things.
That's correct.
A Million Little Thing Pieces.
Yes. A Million Little Pieces of Things.
A Million Things of Peace.
And I can promise for all of those that have been dutifully keeping up, you know, you're going to get some answers. You are. It's not going to be one of those half-ass bring you, string you along and then leave you hanging situations.
I have to. My mom loved Psych, but there are certain shows that she definitely has become that, like, the fan that will walk straight up to someone and just go, why did this happen? Why did you do that? And I'm just, oh. And I realized, I said, Mama, if you can do that, now I get why everyone else does it, because you just knee-jerk. You're like, tell me things.
It's happened quite a bit.
Oh, my God.
I love it because it's just, you know, it's a testament to the fact that, you know, it's having an effect out there.
Sure. But, absolutely. Sure. It's better that people care.
That is the quality of television. That, more than anything else, sets it apart from movies, I think.
Yeah.
Your receptors... as a viewer, work differently. They function differently. It's in your home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different than going to see a movie or even watching a movie at home. So
you become
continued
a part,
success.
You become a part of this journey because it's in your living room every week.
Yep. Continued success to you, sir.
I appreciate it.
Pleasure Very to exciting. Meet you, James.
Thank you both for having me. Thank you for making your book. and leaving an imprint on my childhood.
Well, that's nice to hear.
They make
Always
great doorstops.
Nice
yeah. Just going to yes. mention that. And, heavy as hell.
they were thick.
Great doorstops.
Can people follow you somewhere on social media?
I do have social media accounts. I am just my name. I'm at James Rodet on the Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
The tweets.
And
yes.
on the Instagrams.
Yes. Okay.
That's what I got.
And we, as always...
You are at Leonard Maltin. I am at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff. And you are going to come back when you direct another movie that's going to get a real release, going to go out into the world, and you're going to come back to us as a director, where you're going to feel like a director.
I dig it.
You're going to do it.
Okay. That's a deal.
Black Folks. Panther 2.
Right?
Or
Electric
three.
Boogaloo.
Or
That's
three.
I'm in. I'm
That's
in.
Right.
Let's do it.
Folks, see you next week. Thanks for listening. Maltin on Movies is sponsored today by Legion M, the first fan-owned entertainment company. They've got a lot of good stuff going on, and you can learn about it at legionm.com.